you, and I want to salute you for not allowing Arafat to have another victory. Wherever I was in the States and I was asked, should we send our children to Israel? I said, if you don't send your daughter, you don't send your son. You're giving Arafat another victory. A person has to be reasonably careful, and on that level, we're not any worse than the New York subway system, if you're reasonably careful. Number one. Number two, whatever I said yesterday about the other course applies to this course as well. For attending the course, automatically you get supplementary rabbinic credit for those of you who need it. Anyone who wants graduate school credit has to arrange with the office, which should not be a problem, and then come back to me, we'll work out a paper. Okay. Now, every course or every shayur I've given over the last 33 years that I've been teaching Torah al Admat HaKodesh has a story behind it, how I came to develop the course that I'm giving. As I said, I've never taught anything in the state of Israel that anyone taught me. In the States, it was a Rebbe, it was a Rosh Yeshiva, so I had to say a shir, whatever anyone else said a shir in. But even there, I was a little bit different in the sense I never skipped Gemara. I remember once Reb Mendel Zaks, the Bochin, came and he was mispoiled. You know, I never skipped if it was Agadah or if it was what they face. Easier Gemara, harder Gemara, I never skipped. Because I always live with the principle that when you skip Gemara, you're giving the students a concept that you can play games with the Gemara. You can cut this out, you can put this in, leave this out. And the Agadah and the Halacha are equally important. And Baruch Hashem, I think that viewpoint today is a little bit more widely held than it was in my time when they only studied selected portions of Nashim and Zikin, etc. This course I owe to happening in the Old City in the early 70s. The story is as follows. I had started teaching in Michlala, and I was teaching, as I mentioned, Shelach and Shuvit. Then I developed a more advanced course, which I gave last night. I was giving a basic course, which I also developed on my own, Mavolus Sifrit Chazal. And I had some very wonderful students in Michlala, the Israelis, something outstanding. I've never taught students on that level. One of them was Kalman Kahana's daughter. One of them was Rav Chaim Goldrich's daughter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Karen V'yapne, Zechat Tzadik Levracha. Remember one girl was from North Tel Aviv, she was a Balat Shiva. Her father was the head of a bank. And these were women on an unbelievably high level. So one time they come back from the Old City and they say to me, is it true that my Rebbe didn't say the piyut on Yom Kippur? So I said to them, what are you talking about? The Rav was medayek, medakdek. He said everything. How can it be? What are you talking about? So they said, someone had just come in Aliyah, who's the Talmud Mifak of the Rav. His name is David Hartman. And they heard a lecture in the Old City, and Hartman was quoting Torah from the Rav. And he spoke, and he said that we should close down the shuls at 1 o'clock. The piyut doesn't speak to us, and everyone should go home and concentrate on doing a cheshbon hanefesh. So I said, first of all, girls, what language did Hartman speak? He spoke English. Who says you understand English that well? The girls said, no, we understand English perfectly, which they did. They were graduates. There was a school in Petach Tikva, Lustig, and Lustig was not exactly a Beit Yaakov, but not exactly Mamlachti Dati. And those girls knew English inside out. So I said, did anyone record it? Yeah, we'll bring you a tape. So after Sukkot, they bring me a tape of the lecture. And I listen to it, and I see what happened. Hartman was quoting the Rav, but then quoting the Rav. And then suddenly Hartman shifted gears and went into Hartman. When he went into Hartman, he didn't make clear to the audience, this is now David Hartman, not the Rav. So I saw there's a real problem here. People don't know who the Rav is, and something should be done about it. So I started working on a basic course on the Rav. It was a one-year course at the time. I believe I gave it for the first time in Michlala, 76, 77, or 77. I think it was 76, 77. I gave it for the first time in Michlala. And then I repeated it, then I expanded it to a two-year course. And the fellas pressed me in about 81. They wanted a second course in the Kollel. That was the course they wanted. Originally, there was a problem. I didn't have time, and we went to Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, and I told Aaron what the problem. The boys told him they want the course on the Rav. And if I can only give one course, they prefer that over the Shelet and Shuvat. And Rabbi Aaron said, no, that the Shelet and Shuvat is more important. His answer was, with or without knowing the Rav, you'll be a good Jew. But he said, if you don't understand Shalit and Shuvit and the heartbeat of the halacha, you'll be missing a certain avenue of psak and the learning that's very important. Then about 81, 82, I began giving the course here, and it developed, and some of you know, if you've read the introduction to my work on the Rav, I explain how those two volumes developed out of the classes I was giving here in Gris. Now, it actually developed from three lectures that I gave in 1987, and the description is in the book. Now, I want to come to the two volumes I published. I was zeichet to publish on my Rebbe, and I want to explain what's happening now, because over a year ago, beginning with March 2000, I put the course at rest, and I'm taking out two and a quarter years to do something very different, and perhaps something important for the future. 50 years from now, we'll know whether it left an impact or didn't leave an impact. And the story is as follows. I started writing the two volumes, the Rav, back in 1987 as a direct result of what happened to the Kol. I don't want to go into it because I describe it in the introduction. Right after Rebbe died, within a year, my colleague and my childhood friend, the Rebbe Heschel Schechter, some of you are talmidim of his, published Nefesh HaRav. And Rebbe Heschel was widely criticized that he tried to do too much in the volume. He tried to describe the Rav's Hashkafa, the Rav's philosophy, and the some Chidushim on the Pasha, in addition to the Maisa Rav, which is the high point of the Sefer. So, and he was widely criticized. Fine, some of it has been published, the criticism, some of it he's responded to, but the criticism is a valid criticism, that the Sefer, a year after the Rav died, attempted to do a total portrait, and if you judge it on that level, it falls short. If you judge it on the level of the Nefesh HaRav, of Maisa Rav, on that level, it's fabulous. So, wanting to profit from what's happened before me, I was very careful to state in the introduction that my two volumes on the Rav are not a critical biography, are not a definitive biography. As a matter of fact, it's 50 years too early to even think about a definitive biography. In addition, I could never write a definitive biography because I knew the Rav. And any scholar knows that if you knew a person, you cannot do a definitive biography because you have a prejudice. It's my Rebbe. What can I tell you? Mori your Rebbe. Shali v'shalo, shalohu. I lived, isn't the day that's gone by in my life since 1956, let's say, when I haven't mentioned the Rav's name, I haven't studied with the Rav, etc. So, can't do a definitive biography. If I did two definitive works in my life, one on Rabbi Revel, one on Rabbi Silva, it's because I never knew Rabbi Revel, because I never knew Rabbi Silva, and because I was able to do this work after Rabbi Revel, many years after he was gone, and after Rabbi Silva, a substantial number of years after he was gone. So I was very careful to write an introduction that in these two volumes I'm just dealing with one aspect of the Rav, the aspect of his ability to recreate the world in which he grew up, the world in which he lived, the world in which he functioned, and in these two volumes I totally, completely excluded Rakefet. I tried to be as honest as I could, not to allow any of my own insights, theories, visions color the two volumes. It should be the Rav Neto, Kemoshom Rimbi Yivrit. Did I succeed? Didn't I succeed? So I'll tell you. In the United States, the reviews have ranged from very good to fantabulous, and Baruch Hashem, I think in the United States I can say people have read the volume, have been honest about it, and they realized I try to work on one area, and in that area perhaps I've succeeded. I'll only quote Moshe Meiselman, who said behind my back in front of an audience of hundreds, the first volumes have appeared on my uncle where the author had no political agenda and are totally honest. I may only quote Saul Berman, who said behind my back, he doesn't even know I know he said it, to hundreds of people at some Ada session, where he stated the first two volumes have appeared on the Rav that are totally honest with no political agenda. The author has kept himself out of it. In the state of Israel, I have been slaughtered. I have dalad mitot beitin. One review is worse than another. It all begins with a review that appears in Jerusalem Report, signed by Professor Moshe Sokolow, who I believe is from the YU faculty. Most of it was ghostwritten by Chaim Soloveitchik, which now it's an established fact. Chaim has admitted it to people. And in that review, they review a book that was never written. They never read the books. and I can prove it from the review. It's not important. But that's not important. What is important is they review a book that's never written. They take me to task for not writing a definitive work of the Rav. And every review in Israel has followed along those lines, beating on a straw man that he didn't write a definitive work of the Rav, instead of reviewing the books within the context of what the author wanted to do. All right, but it doesn't matter. That's part of life. Baruch Hashem, I'm a big boy. I can be beaten. I can be hit. It's not a problem. Thank God. I have good students who will protect me. Now, however, as a result of the criticism, why I didn't analyze, why I didn't give my theories, I took off, as I said, beginning with March of 2000, and I stopped all my shirim under Rav, and I've gone page by page. I hope, Be'ezrat Hashem, if not today, by next week, to finish the first volume, and I've given a super commentary that what I call the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Torah Shebichtav, with all the theories and all the understanding and all the emotion. Jack has all the tapes, and Jack has promised me that he or his children or his grandchildren will get the tapes to the next generation or two generations hence, when someone will sit down and do a definitive work on the Rav, and he can listen and hear what I have to say. He can agree or disagree, but at least it will add to the sources. Halavai, I had such sources available when I was working on Rabbi Revel and Rabbi Silva. Yes? Had I known the Rav so well, forget it, it's not for now. I was his Talmud, that's all I'll answer you. But I can only tell you, the letter I reproduce to protect myself, because I had no intention of putting in the Rav's, one of the Rav's letters to me, and I only put it in as a result of the Kollel, because I told the fellas that what's happened after the Rav died was just the most shocking thing in the world, where you hear descriptions of the Rav that Nishke Shteig and Nishke Flagen have no basis in reality. Either the Rav is a great Jewish philosopher, was never a yeshiva, or the Rav is a great Rosh Yeshiva who never dealt in Jewish philosophy. Either the Rav was a brisker who never went to college, or the Rav was cool at college who never saw brisk. So I have a problem. Some of my own students went very black in the 70s, and they're big London, one of them is a great London. And he came to me before I published, and I can't go into details, but I was a little bit frightened that he'll go and say, who's our Rabbi Rakep? It's not a student, the Rav, I'm a student. These guys are capable, the Art Scroll generation is capable of anything. They're capable of telling you it's nighttime outside. And if you don't believe it, you're an apikoros. That's the Art Scroll generation. So I was worried stiff, they'll say, I never studied with the Rav. So I asked Tov, I said, Tov, you know that I don't want to indulge in self-aggrandizement. This letter, Rabbi Lichtenstein called the most important letter he ever saw written by the Rav. And it happens to be addressed to me, so I don't have to go any further. So I published it to protect myself, Baruch Hashem. So no one can say, I didn't know the Rav, I didn't study with the Rav, I didn't correspond with the Rav, I don't understand. Baruch Hashem, I know, thank God. Okay, now, all I can tell you is 2 volumes, 600 pages, it's now been around a year and a half, no one but no one has found one mistake. Not one. Rabban Soloveitchik questioned one thing, I can't comment on it now, I explained last year, where it's a field of choice. In other words, with Reb Moshe's Bar Mitzvah in Voloshin, with Nit in Voloshin, it's a field of choice, because Voloshin already, the students were gone, the building was open, it was closed a week later, so, Be'ezrat Hashem, if there'll be a third edition or a Hebrew edition, I'll revise the sentence slightly, okay? Find the next error. There will be an error in a moment. Okay, now, with that being said, I want to begin the year, first of all, on the basis of what I've spoken about until now, and I want to mention, you'll be able to understand me with or without the Rav in front of you. Obviously, if you own it, it's worthwhile bringing it. You might want to make notes on the side if I correct something, if I make a further comment, so perhaps it's worth putting a note, an emendation on the side. However, with or without the Rav, you'll be able to understand me because you'll see my style and what I'm trying to do. Now, I want to come back to what I've said last year. I want to make one correction. But before I come to the correction, because the correction comes in today's shiur, it's a correction not on what's published, but what I've said orally. I want to come back to something we discussed in class, and I want to establish history in the classroom with a recorded document that sheds light, and it's from the Baal Dava himself. Some of you may recall the most traumatic experience we had as Talmidim of the Rav was in 1960. 1960, the Rav gave the Hesped for the Brisker Rav for Velvelvel. It's the very famous Hesped that was published under the title Mad Dodi Mei Dodeich. What happened at that Hesped, and this is very important from a historic point of view, this split, as I mentioned yesterday, Torah Vadas, YU, Chaim Berlin, RJJ, we were all in the same camp. There was a little bit jealousy, a little bit rivalry, but the world was one. What went on in Torah Vadas, within a day, we knew about in Yeshivas Pesachana, what went on in Yeshivas and they knew about in Torah Vadas. There was cross-pollinization, the Rashi Yeshiva knew each other. Many of them were Altamira, many of them were Shanghai survivors, and the world was not split the way it is today. When does the split begin? In my humble opinion, and I make this clear in what I consider the best chapter I've ever written in the Silver Era, where I deal with post-World War II orthodoxy, by 1956, the right wing felt strong enough to issue the famous Issa against the mixed board of rabbis or the synagogue council. And that took a lot of strength, because you have to understand in America, before that period, the greatest rabbanim sat with reform and conservative rabbis. When that Issa was issued in 57, if you go to Camden, New Jersey, that area, Camden, Cherry Hill, those of you familiar with it, the mixed board of rabbis, the president was Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Riff, the great-grandson of the Netziv of Elashin. No one had a larger beard in the American rabbinate than Rav Riff of Camden. While the Issa is being issued, he is president of the mixed board. But that Issa shows you that Lakewood, right-wing orthodoxy, had come, it now had strength, it was not afraid to open their mouth. Of course, the person who didn't sign the Issa was the Rav. And it's not for now, I've lectured on it extensively, what his viewpoint was. It's not for now. I'm sure you're familiar with it. The Rav refused to sign the Issa. Because the Rav didn't sign the Issa, you had 11 Rosh Yeshiva who signed, but to a certain degree, they were nullified, or they were canceled, or there was a cross weight against them, and that was the Rav. Of course, the Rav carried tremendous prestige. He was the Rav. When all was said and done, he was certainly the equal to anyone in yeshivish learning in Brisket Torah, and in addition, he was the Rav with all that that implies. So now you have this tremendous split. By 1960, the tension is palatable. And here the Rav announces he's giving a hesped for Reb Velfel. There were threats arriving at the yeshiva that they're going to be bombs, they're going to blow them up. There was a telegram that arrived, how dare you give a hesped for your uncle in such a place, paraphrasing such a makom tumah. For the first time, and I'm telling you, Eidat Nemana, there was separate seating. Until then, whenever the Rav gave a public lecture, a tshuva drasha, a yartzai drasha, there were women, and there was no separate area for women. The women sat on the side, but it wasn't like there was a separate area. They sat, well, a woman here, a husband here. They were, to a certain degree, intermingled. For the chesped, for the briska Rav, for the first time, women up to the balcony, you all know Lampert Auditorium, the men downstairs. Now, in the middle of the chesped, and those of you familiar with the written word, and it, as far as I know, it only exists in Lashon HaKodesh, there's no art scroll translation, but this is missing from the chesped. The Rav ad-libbed. The Rav was trying to develop, and this is very famous, Moshe Meiselman tries to do to the Rav in a tradition article what the Rav did to his uncle. And what the Rav said in the chesped was that my uncle couldn't deal with anything, couldn't relate to anything that was beyond the halachic context. Says, this was my uncle. His world was simply halachic concepts. Everything was a halachic concept. Anything that was not a halachic concept, the Brisker Rav could not relate to. And he said, I'll give you an example. And he ad-libbed. And the Rav said, when Ben-Gurion wanted to see my uncle refused. The Chazon Ish received him. And this is absolutely true. When Ben-Gurion was involved in his big fights over Mihu Yehudi and Gius Banim Latzava and then Gius Banat and Sherit Lumi, these were tremendous fights back in the early 50s that the decisions, the outcomes of those controversies have established the state of Israel with all its good and all its problems until today. And Ben-Gurion wanted to see the two greatest Rabbanim. First of all, he wanted to smack the face. I mean, this is my interpretation. That's the interpretation. I was a kid then, but it was the interpretation of all the Mizrahi leaders. He wanted to smack the face of the chief rabbinate to show that Rabbi Herzog doesn't have a monopoly, there's the Brisker Rav, there's the Chazon Ish. So the Brisker Rav refused to see him. The Chazon Ish agreed to see him. Now, what the Rav was showing, I have to tell you, he said it very dramatically. I can, as I told you yesterday, I'm hearing the Rav with one ear, and I hear you 50 years from now with the other ear. Yes, Ein Hachinam. He said it very dramatically. I'm living it at this very second. But what the Rav was saying is very simple. I'll give you a simple example. Imagine, for the state of argument, Ehud Barak wants to visit the Kollel, the Gris Kollel. Ehud Barak. Or I'll give you a better example. Danny Kurtzer. Am I pronouncing his name right? The former dean of Yeshiva College. The ambassador of the greatest country in the world, the United States of America, to the lowly, humble state of Israel. Danny Kurtzer wants to visit the Kollel. Aaron Rakefet will walk out. I will not stay in his presence. I guarantee you that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein will stay in his presence, and Rabbi David Miller will have to stay because his Rebbe is staying. Now I ask you a question. Who's the better Jew, Rakefet or Rabbis Lichtenstein and Miller? Okay, now you play with that question. And if you come up with an answer, you're a bigger dummy than I thought. You follow me? It's nothing to do with being a better Jew. It has to do with your personality. And I can't help it. I am a Kanoi. I love Torah. And you're at Shemayim, and the Jewish people, and I'm Yisrael. I'm a fool. I grew up in Akiva, and I believe every word I was taught, and I sacrificed my entire life for a very simple aphorism. Eretz Yisrael, La'am Yisrael, Alpi Torah Yisrael. That's the start of my kefet, the end of my kefet. Danny Kurtzer and I cannot sit in the same room. I'm sorry. The covet of the 11,000 students I taught will not allow it. Period. Am I better than a Baalif? It's a difference in personality. Nothing to do with value judgment. Now, the auditorium was packed. Some guy walked out. And when someone walks out, the Rav is speaking, so everyone noticed. 4 or 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, he walked back in. And he started shouting at the Rav, Du hast mevazig gewend de Chazon Ish, you insulted the Chazon Ish, you insulted the Chazon Ish. And the Rav didn't know what to do. And we were petrified. This was our Rebbe. You don't know how we related to the Rav. In one of the reviews, one of the review written now in Pap Gesha, how dare Rakefet, he describes the Rav like he's a Hasidic Rebbe. I'm worried of more. Yes, we related to the Rebbe. Believe me, for us, he was a Hasidic Rebbe. I mean, he wouldn't let us relate as Hasidim. But we desperately wanted to relate as Hasidim. So we didn't know, we were petrified. Our Rebbe is embarrassed. There was a voice from above. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein doesn't remember this. I couldn't get over it. The Rebbetzin yelled from upstairs. Rabbi Aaron's mother-in-law-to-be yelled from upstairs, take him out of there! Take him out of there! And then someone jumped on this individual, pushed him out, knocked him out, and took him out. Okay. Now, I told this in class. It's an important, and I dealt with it. You have to hear the tape. It becomes an important, then there's the full follow-up. The next day, the Rav goes into the hospital for his cancer operation, and the Rav doesn't appear in public again until Ben-Gurion, and there's a whole interconnection, which I can't repeat. It's on tape. And I explained that this, too, was symbolic of the tremendous break in orthodoxy that the right and the left parted company, and you see it with the Easter of 57, you see it what happened in 1960, when the Rav is embarrassed, criticized in public. And then I mentioned on the tape in the class here, I said, and fellas, I want you to know, said it to last year's Kollel, the Kollel a year ago, whenever it was that I hit this part of the lecture, that there was a shmua that when that person went out, he went into the phone booth, and he called Rav Huttner, his Rebbe, and Rav Huttner told him to make a mocha. I said, there was a shmua, and then he came back in. Now, the tape of these lectures, as I said yesterday, I have more students via tape than in the classroom, which is unfortunate, because in the classroom, you can look eye to eye. So it's an open gemara. There has to be eye-to-eye contact between the Rebbe and Talmud. When you have many students via tape, there's no interaction. So some students, oh, I know who it is. He's in his late 60s, 70s, early 70s. Listened to the tape. And the person that insulted the Rav, or criticized the Rav, or shouted at the Rav, use whatever word you want, is a very famous posek today who has a large following and to a certain degree has bridged the gap between Chaim Berlin, and he has a large following from Yeshivas Bishol Chanan, and his name is Rav David Cohn, the Gvul Yavitz in Flatbush. So someone went and told him that I said that he called Rav Hutner. I was misquoted, obviously. I understand the person heard the tape. I couldn't have said it. I was sitting inside. I said there was a shmua. In a second, I'm going to play for you Rav David Cohn reacting to the shmua, washing me through the floor, dragging me through the mud. However, and believe me, I kol hakavod to him. I enjoy every second of it. It's fabulous. Now, what's important, no, to be dragged through the mud is very important. You're learning the Silat Yesharim. I would say right away, the first sign of a great Jew is that he knows that he can be dragged through the mud and he walks away smiling. That is the sign of greatness. That's the sign of Torah and Yirat Shemayim and humility and humbleness and everything that we should strive for, be Yemei Elul and the days that are coming up. Now, what's crucially important is he tells the whole story. Yes, he admits there was a shmua that I called Rabbi Hutner. He says, I didn't call Rabbi Hutner. I didn't go into the phone booth. There's a play here on Superman. You'll hear in a second, or Captain, yes, Superman. And he says, but Rabbi Hutner called me the next morning to give me a Yasha Kayach. So you see, that validates my thesis. The split was already there. Here, he embarrasses the Rav, and you have to know Rabbi Hutner's relationship with the Soloveitchik family was a Ben Bayit in Warsaw. When Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Aral, is a little kid studying for his bar mitzvah, his father hires Rav Hutner to teach him. He was a Ben Bayit. And here, Rav Hutner gives him a Yashar Koyach for embarrassing the Rav. What's even more fascinating from the point of view of history, because all you fellas sitting here today are tzaddikim, kedoshim, baruch Hashem, and I have to tell you the truth, even though I don't wear a black hat and don't wear black clothes and don't wear the uniform, but I have to tell you, when I see what's going on in America, I plead with everyone, if you're going to go back to the States, two black hats, two uniforms, two gartels. I shiver and shake when I have students who don't have that Hasidic dress, and I proved to the Kola last year conclusively that you are, the minute you wear the uniform, you're a Hasid, but you need it. You need the social fencing in, because where you're going back to, Hashem Yirachem, what's going on in the United States and going on in part of the YU world. And wherever I went, I get whipped, because Trisharis announced women are chazaniyot already and aliyot and everything that goes with it. Of Hashem Yirachem, I'll share it tomorrow. You know what's very fascinating here? Gentlemen, you have confidence. John, you know where you're going to be 10, 20, 30 years from now? You have confidence, eh? Wipe that smile off your face and tremble, because you know who the person is? Who? Relax, let the Rebbe handle it. When I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. Don't confuse me. Don't confuse me with the facts. Please, we had enough trouble yesterday with Jackson and Yankelevich and Ben Yaakov. I have to tell you, Jackson is the most important name in the world. I don't have time yet. We'll get to it at a certain point when I've gone too much, then I'll loosen up and I'll make Dr. Jackson dance for joy. Gentlemen, you know who knocked over David Cohn and almost killed him for insulting the Rav? Would anyone want to venture a guess? Joseph Blau is a kid. God, 40 years ago, he's in short pants with me. Joseph? Jerry Blau. Joseph Blau, suddenly. Jerry and I go back 50 years. 40 years ago, he was a kid in short pants. David Hartman. Harab Duvi Hartman. Chaim Berlin. Lakewood. YU. The man who just came out with a book where he falsifies the Rav in confrontation. Falschkeit 100%. He's the guy who almost killed David Cohn. No one believes me? Let the tape roll. Okay, now, disconnect the microphone.
With a few blind changes. So, lean that, I wrote it down. I gotta read it to you, because it's good stuff. It's really, okay. It's humorous. The island really enjoyed it. So, lean that, we'll play it for you.
I'd like to go back to the kid.
The continue to kill him?
Yeah, look at this. There is a boy in hospital and a wife is...
Kill it. Okay. Let me explain what's happening. We'll make it a drop out. It becomes very clear. You'll see. Here's what's happening. A very delicate Shaila came up. A woman who's a machanechet, a kid of 16, doesn't want to put on tefillin because he says that tefillin come from animals that are slaughtered. He's a vegetarian. He doesn't want to put on tefillin. They asked the Gvul Yavetz, they asked from David Cohen, and he said, you got to tell the kid off, you got to wash the floor with him. The people involved came to me with the same question. And I said as follows, tell the kid you appreciate his feelings, build him up, don't push the kid away. This is the whole lesson we learn from Pashat Nazir. Nazir is not a normal situation. But if a person has those type of feelings, we have to be able to deal with it halachically and give him an outlet that will be acceptable to Torah and will enable him to feel vent to his emotion. We don't want everyone to be a Nazir. Nazir has to bring a Kabam Chatat. You all understand that. But certain people have to be a Nazir. I said, build the kid up. Tell him you admire the way he thinks. You admire the fact he won't eat meat. You admire the fact that he's worried about food coming from animals. But you don't have to shecht an animal for tefillin. The halacha is only, it has to be from a min that's kasher. Get him orot that from an animal that was an availer or a trafer or died by itself, and that's what you make the tefillin out of, and there won't be any problem that the animal was geshecht just for the sake of the tefillin. Anyway, they went back to the kid, and it turned out the problem is much deeper, and I just relate to it in passing. It's a tremendous halachic problem. It's a problem that we'll deal with, if not later this year, next year, Be'ezrat Hashem. This kid was adopted by his parents. This I found out later. The kid was adopted, and afterwards the parents had two or three natural children. It was at a time they thought they couldn't have children. The kid deep down resents the other children, although his parents swear, and there's testimony, they treat him as if he's one of their own, 100%. And the kid now is 16, and he found out that when he turned 13, he could have given up Yiddishkeit. So the kid says, when I turned 13, I didn't have enough seichel, I didn't understand. And neinu chinam, I was bar mitzvah. But now that I'm 16, I'm thinking of leaving Yiddishkeit. What do I need this burden for? You follow, it's a very deep psychological problem. It goes way beyond the tefillin. Anyway, they're working with the kid. They used my approach. The person speaking here on the tape is Rabbi Bert Leff. And Rabbi Leff is raising this issue again with Rabbi David Cohen. Rabbi Bert Leff, I spoke about him last year. Why, you graduate a little older than I am, one of the top fellows who studied with the Rav in my time, a very seasoned rabbi, was rabbi of a very important community in Washington, D.C., later worked for synagogues in the OU for many years, today retired, and he is asking David Cohen about that kid, and you'll see David Cohen remains adamant in his position, and then they get involved in the whole problem with the phone call to Rav Putna, and you'll hear David Cohen's response.
Trying to influence. He has a mishigas that he will not put on fill because fill comes from a slaughtered animal. So, I don't know if you know Aaron Rakefer, real quick.
Of course I know that.
Yeah. So they were all right.
He's a historian.
Right.
You know what makes him a historian? He got everything wrong.
You know what I mean?
They told me there's a tape where he tells over the story of my confrontation with Yosher Bear. There's not one thing that's true there. There's not one, whatever they told me, I would love to hear the tape. There's not one thing that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, a historian.
What do you think he said? Let's go.
I was told.
I'm going to give him this tape. Go ahead.
Well, I'll let me tell you the real story so you'll know everything that's wrong.
Okay.
Everything they told me was wrong.
Okay,
I got a signal from the outside, and Rav Hutner told me to make a protest. Lie. They're both, I mean, it's just lies. I mean, I know, but at the time, right afterwards, I heard that somebody said that. Why was it necessary for me to get a signal outside with a car? Now's the time to protest! Why was it necessary?
I'm just telling you.
But it's totally shaken. Even if we'll find some sort of motive that somebody had to signal me by hearing the honking of the car.
All right, that's not...
It's absurd. The whole thing is absurd.
what he said. I don't know about the signal. I heard.
You have a tape?
Yes, I have.
Can you give me a copy?
I have to find it.
Please do. And then I'll make a tape and I'll send
it.
Well, at least call me to find out if you're sorry.
Right. What he said was that you went into the telephone booth.
No, to change to my Superman outfit.
And that's what he said.
That's much closer to the truth. You're laughing, but that's much closer to the truth. I didn't make any telephone call to anybody.
Right. This was your idea, right? The protest.
It wasn't even my idea.
Yeah.
So you tell me what he said, and I'll tell you.
He said simply like this, that when the Roman...
Oh, and he said, forget that I then voted against the Khazar nation and for the Roman. That's what someone told me.
No.
Right.
That's what someone told me.
I have the tape.
Maybe the one who told me is also historian.
Let me tell you what the tape says. Right. Thank you.
Go ahead.
The tape simply says that you were there, and you were very upset. And
true.
You went outside, you went into the telephone booth, called Rafputin, and Rafputin said, make a tarah. And that's all he said.
That's all he said.
And that's not true, right?
No, it's a check of the chazal. That's no. And not only that, it was...
Now,
but,
so
I'll tell you exactly what happened, because it's kedai l'manis.
I'm going to let him hear this. Go ahead. He's here now. He's here for another.
Fine, please tell him. No, but I'm upset. A historian.
Right.
First of all, how does he know with which historian? One thing I want to tell you. Even if he's a Baruch HaKadosh, you can't mix Ruach HaKadosh, like a Baal HaKadosh. Leib HaShemayim, you can't mix it in. A historian needs some fact. Rav Kutna didn't tell him. Anyone close to Rav Kutna, well, they couldn't have told him. Rav Kutna didn't tell anybody. If Rav Kutna didn't tell me what to do. So how do you find out? Who told him the secret? And if he knows it's Ruach HaKadosh, he can't use it as history. Okay, that's one rule. The Maisa Shehoyah Kachoyah, I was sitting next to my shavuot. The reason we were there is really at the age that I was at, we already stopped going to Rav Yoshe Ber. It's a Tzunz Nishka Pas.
How old were you then? How old were you?
It was right after my marriage. Not only was it right after my marriage.
18.
The week before, Rabaran, his son-in-law, was a Ben Chosin, came with his collar to my house for Shalosh Shuvos. That Shabbos before, we were very close friends. So they came for Shalosh Shuvos to my
house. You're talking about our
listeners? Came to them. So, and that, the reason we went is because I remember it was a time there was a very close friend who was lifted, and there was a Hechatimtsu where all the Hespedim, the Oilam, didn't go to him. So Nizke Pasch, we used to go to the yard site. 4, 5, 6 years before, we used to go to the yard site. We didn't pass already. For whatever the inner pressures in the yeshiva, you don't go. Whoever made it such, why did we rationalize to go? And I believe many others who stopped going because we didn't hear a hesped on the brisket of, so we had a good rationalization with the sukta hetta, you know. So we had a rationalization to go here, and we figured he's going to say some hesped. We didn't hear one hesped because there were a lot of conflicts in that particular schedule that we couldn't hear a hesped. But the beginning does a hesped. I was with my shotgun, who was right over here to my left. Matthias Greenblatt is his name. So he was with me, and we're listening. And then he gave that dig that the uncle was not like the Chazon Ish who met with Ben Gurion. It was clear to an interpretation of a knocking of the Chazon Ish that he met with Ben Gurion, because the uncle was Emes Lamita, you understand? Right? I was very upset. I looked at Marcus and said, what do you mean, you know, what is this? I walked out. I figured, I'll wait. We came with a car. So I walked towards the car, and I was steaming. And I figured, I'll wait until we'll finish. And I became very impatient. It wasn't my car. He says, I'm waiting for the ride. So I figured, I went, and not only did it bother me that Montes is staying, you know, it bothered me. So I walked back in, I come over, I said, Montes, I said, you're not allowed to sit here. You got to get out. I told the mothers. So even though I figured we would have to wait anyway, because we came with another, we came with a full car. But at least, I mean, I'm on table where the others were sitting, I didn't know. I walked to the back, and I saw your brother-in-law, Rav Putnoy, Zichrono Livracha, in the last seat. He was in the last seat, like two or three away. So I knew him. He went substituted for Rav Snow, so I knew. So I gave him a shalom, you know. And I got so upset, and I must tell you, it happens to me so occasionally. I was so upset, so I was saying to him, How do you sit here? And before I knew, I can't explain, I couldn't control myself. So I turned around, I started to shout. That's what happened. Whatever it is, I didn't even know what I said. But I was totally like in a chzosei shed. Or maybe I think it was the Ruach HaTara, not the Ruach HaTum. I was like a chzosei. I was totally not myself. And David Hartman, my old bosom pal, comes charging like a shor hamud, where I could see the steam coming out, and he runs over to me, and I think my brother-in-law, Tamitsha, my oldest brother-in-law, grabbed me to help me out, because I saw steam. And David Hartman, in total rage, the same rage that I had, said, if I didn't love you, I would kill you.
He said that to
me? That's what he said. If I didn't love you so much, I would kill you, he said. And it was like, that's all I know about it, because I didn't, that's what happened. I was not in touch with myself. I was in total, I was in a rage. I was really in a rage, because I really felt like that. I mean, it was like, go explain it away. I was in a rage. I mean, everything else. And you can say nice things about the younger boys. We have to, what do you need this? Anyway, that's not the point. This was the story Meisa showed. That was the story. So then it came back. There was a signal. There was a call. I was signaled. I couldn't understand, why do I need the signal for it? That people, I never went to any telephone incident. There was no such thing. I never went to a telephone. Except to change, like I just told you. But it's conceivable that I called her a putna. It's conceivable that I called, say, Rebbe, am I allowed to do this, or whatever it is. It's conceivable, but it ain't true, as we say in Brooklyn, because I didn't give a thought. I didn't give a thought. When I walked in, I didn't give a thought. Even when I said hello to Rav Putnoizachar and Lavrach, I didn't give a thought. It's just when I started talking to him, I got so upset, before I knew it, I was shouting at him, and then I turned around and started shouting. That's what happened. Exactly, I'm giving it to you exactly for the rest of my life.
I'm going to borrow the tape from you.
Because I'm just telling you. It's possible for a historian without verification to say anything, and it doesn't even make sense. I mean, without verification, who told them? How did I know? What do you mean? They told them that their footman said, I called, whatever. It's ridiculous. I may have mentioned to friends later that the morning after, Rav Huttner called me, and he said to me, I don't know who was there, but they told him, Al-Yevish men ha-maligin, that's what he said to me. Al-Yevish men ha-maligin, because he knew that people were going to blast me. But I got, by some people, I got the blast treatment. So that is true. And maybe one told the other, I don't know, that could be. But this is Shekhar. This is what happened, not come.
Right. Let's go back to this.
You're recording? You have me recording. Okay. Excuse me?
He did make the call.
No. He says Rabbi Huttner called him the next day. But
he says buried in there, the town is, I may have called him.
No, say that. But anyway, halacha l'maisa. No. You're absolutely right, but that's not germane now. What is germane? That there's total agreement between your humble servant and one of the Gedolei Yisrael in the New York area on what happened that night. I never claimed, how could I be so foolish? I was sitting inside, there was a shmua. And he says, yes, there was a shmua. What's amazing is, who charged him? Duvi Hartman, where we are 40 years later, where both of them are. Remember, he's talking to a YU crowd in this shiur. This is not a shiur just for the black world. Half the people sitting there are a YU crowd. What's amazing, where both of them are, but the facts are the facts, and I claim once again that when you will write the history of American Torah Judaism, American Orthodoxy, one big date is 1957 or 56 with the Iser on the mixed board of rabbis. What happens in 1960, and you hear the way he describes it, that they were ashamed already to come to the Rav. You weren't allowed to go. You weren't allowed to go uptown. You weren't allowed to step foot in YU. But they came that night because they wanted to hear the Hesped on the Brisker Rav and take a look what happens. No, he doesn't regret it at all. I have a second tape where he responds to this. He says, oh, I'm happy to hear that. It's not important. I'm going to play the second tape. It's not as germane. But I'm happy to hear that we're both telling the same story now. He comes down and he doesn't regret all. He says, why do we even talk about it? It's a shanda for the Rav. He doesn't realize it's a shanda for him, not for the Rav. But what the Rav said, and the point is well taken, it has nothing to do with value judgment. You can be the Brisker Rav, you can be the Chazon Ish. It's a difference absolutely in personality. Four volumes appear today on the Brisker Rav by Rabbi Fetish, son-in-law, Megla. I've gone through every word in the four volumes. And you see, the Brisker Rav was the Brisker Rav. He was different, he was unique, he was iconoclastic in many different ways. It doesn't mean that he's better or more valuable. It only means he was unique. That's all. And that was the Rav's Vart, and it rings in my ears until today. But from the point of view of history, we clinched a certain topic and we left a valuable document, Latid Lavo. Okay, at this point, I want to go further. Yes?
How did the Rav know his uncle so well? What did that
direction? Well, the Rav knew his uncle. First of all, you have to understand, the Rav, you asked me a better question. How did the Rav know Rav Chaim so well? How many times did he see Rav Chaim? How many times do you think the Rav saw Rav Chaim in his lifetime? No, so he knew his uncle through his father. And in Warsaw, the uncle came to visit the father a number of times. They spoke in learning, and they corresponded. As a matter of fact, in the volume of Igrot Tagrid, there's even material that the Rav wrote to his uncle. And you'll see from the footnote where the uncle quotes the Rav, although not by name, in his Chidushim, where the Chidushim were published in his name. So there was a relationship between them. And then when the Brisker Rav son-in-law came to America, who was his patron saint? When Rav Yechiel Michael Feinstein came to America, who was his patron saint, if not the Rav? And until today, when you talk with Rav Yechiel Michael Feinstein, you will not hear one syllable of criticism against the Rav. What you will hear is that it's not true, he was not a Mizrachiite, he was not the president, honorary president. Now, that's art scroll. But the Rav remains the Rav. So there was a definitive relationship there. And the Rav admired his uncle. You know, his words on Zionism are fabulous words, which I quote from the Rav word by word, which was in that Hesped from Mado Dimi Del Deich, where the Rav says, who's the greatest Zionist? The American Mizrahi who holds meetings does. Leaders who sit in a five-star hotel and carry on great politics about Israel, or my uncle who refuses to leave Yerushalayim. As far as I know, I have yet to see a tape of Ma Dodi Mi Dodeich. I have my notes. The Rav later published it in Hebrew. He gave it in Yiddish, but I have never yet seen the tape. Rabbi Yerucham Yerelik used to say that in that chesped, the Rav reached the absolute heights of defining Brisk. And that's what it's most famous for. I cited in my footnotes. If you want to understand what Brisk is about, you have to see the Hesped. Okay, now let me go a drop further, and I want to make a correction on a mistake I made, not in the book, but something I said in class. And I want to come into what I want to talk about today, and it'll carry us into next week, and continue with the Rav. Now, Rebbe taught me a lot, and Rebbe gave me a hashgafa, which I live with until today. Some of you know that in Midrashut Moriah Be'ezrat Hashem on Sunday, I'll begin 1 year's worth of courses on one man's struggle to be a Torah Jew in the modern world. I would like to say that if my Rebbe heard me give these lectures, he would be satisfied. I'll put it that way. I would like to say that. I hope I'm right. There's certain aphorisms I coined that represent, to me, the totality of the Rav. There are two that stand out in my mind. One I mentioned yesterday, with one here I hear my Rebbe of 50 years ago, with the other here I hear you 50 years from now. Certainly on that aphorism, and if you look into the letter I have from the Rav, we could lecture for 1 year. It's the heart of Torah, the heart of Torah Shavuot Peh, the heart of being a Torah Jew, the heart of why orthodoxy is authentic. I hate the word orthodoxy. It was forced upon us by our opponents. It means narrow-mindedness. We are the most open-minded people in the world, most open-minded religion in the world. We're the only religion in the world that says you don't have to be a good Jew to get Olam Haba. If you're born a Gentile, observe Sheva Mitzvah, and according to Pirkei the Rebbe Eliezer, Chassid Yom Atlam, there's even a Gesa Kru Yisrael Ad Kedei Kach. So we're the most open-minded people in the world. But our enemies called us orthodox, one way, orthodox, one doctrine, narrow-minded. I hate to use the word, but I'll use it. To me, that's the heart of orthodoxy, 50 years, and that's why I have very little nachat out of the announcement by Drisha that women are going to be chazaniyot for Pesukei Dezimra, women are going to be called for the Torah. For me, it's another form of conservative Judaism. They didn't do it 50 years ago, and good Jews will not be doing it 50 years from now, period. There's a lot more to speak. It's not for now. Now, there's a second aphorism which I think characterizes my Rebbe. And this, of course, is, to me, the Rav's strong point. This, of course, is the Rav's weak point, where Art Scroll will always criticize him. And it's very simple. I've come up with the following aphorism. I'll say it in my name. I hope it reflects my Rebbe. I'm the greatest believer in pluralism after the Naseh V'Nishma. And this was a precious gift we got from the Rav. The Rav never degraded any other form of Torah. Yes, he could give a critique why Brisk perhaps was better than Rav Hirsch, why Brisk was better than Chassidus. On the other hand, he could just as easily describe German Orthodoxy, describe the Hasidic world, that you had to pinch yourself to realize the Rav was not a devotee of Hirsch and the Rav was not a Chassid. And this to me was a magnificent gift that Rebbe gave us. I'm the greatest believer in pluralism after the Naseh V'Nishma. And it was a certain broadness that was overwhelming. Now, before I come into Chaslavich, I want to make one correction, and I want to tell you who I'm in debt to. I'm very much in debt. I have a Talmud Chaver in Lubavitch by the name of Rabbi Aryeh Lieberman. And he's a first-rate Talmud Chacham, and he does his homework, and he's a real, real pedantic scholar. He's Talmud HaMachkimet Rabbo. He constantly comes up with sources for me and theories. Sometimes he's right, sometimes he's not entirely right, but he's always, his mind is innovative. Now, I told the following story in class when I dealt with the Lubavitch and Rebbe's life a long time ago. And I told them I was very privileged. Something happened when I was a kid that, what happened was very simple. The year was 1967. I already was a Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva at that time for a number of years, and Rebbe was sitting shiva for his mother. Because I had to say shir from 9 to 10, if I recall, the boys had preparation, and I began shir at about 10 o'clock. So I went over to Be Menachem Avel early. It was about 9:15 in the morning. I left the kids. I said, look, I'm going across the street. Rebbe's sitting shiva in his mother's home, and I'm going to Lenachem Avel. So I came across the street, and it was quite early, and there was, by American standards, by Israeli standards, 9:15 is the middle of the day. In America, as you know, businesses don't open until 9:30, 10. So I came across the street, and Rebbe was there all alone, and I'm sitting with Rebbe about 2 minutes, and there's a knock on the door, and two Jews appeared with patriarchal appearance, long flowing beards, and they come in with a letter, they're shlichim of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, two gabayim. One is Rabbi Jacobson and Rebbe's Rabbi Gordon. Two gabayim bringing the Rav a letter from the Rebbe of Nichum Avel. By 1967, the Rebbe already had not left 770 Eastern Parkway, or that little area between his home and 770 and the grave of the previous Rebbe. The Rebbe never left. It was simply a question of time, and the demands upon the Rebbe's time were such, as you know, by the early 70s, if I'm not mistaken, he already stops Yechidus. Until that time, you can have Yechidus with the Rebbe. By the early 70s already, that has to be stopped. Every chassid would have Yechidus on his birthday. And there are now thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of chassidim. It's just impossible for one man who carries Klal Yisrael on his shoulders. So these two people walk in, and I was a kid sitting there, and I see these Jews, Rabbi Yochanan Gordon, and the other one was Rav Yisrael Jacobson. And they bring the letter, and the Rav, I see his face lights up when he sees them, and he gets involved in the whole conversation. And then when they leave, he tells me things privately, which I spoke about in class, which opened my mind to the Rav and his whole relationship with Chabad. His actual, I would say, the love and respect, to a certain degree, the awe which he had for Chabad, for their Mesirat Nefesh. Now, I said in class that Rav Yochanan Gordon was the father of Rav Shalom Dovber Gordon, who was rabbi with me at the other end of Maplewood, and I knew him very well. This was his father. He's one of the Rebbe's Gabbayim. He's buried right near the Rebbe. And I said that Rabbi Jacobson is the father of the publisher of the Allgemeine Journal, which is a Orthodox Yiddish-English paper, which has Chabad leanings. The publisher has written about the Rebbe, and I made a mistake. It's a different Jacobson altogether. And this is the correction I want to make, and I have to thank Rabbi Liebman, who got me Xerox for me, a volume that came out, Sefer Lubavitch for Chayaleh. That's one thing about Lubavitch. They published pictures. I saw their shlichim, four volumes that came out in the 1990s of all their shlichim all over the world with beautiful, magnificent color pictures. I guess it's giving them a bit of support because they're in every place you can imagine, every favof and a dof, and here at least they published their pictures. So from this volume, he shows me this is Rabbi Yochanan Gordon and this is Rav Yisrael Jacobson, and it's a different Jacobson altogether. I simply confused Jacobson with Jacobson, and I didn't realize that there could be more than one Rav Jacobson, who is extremely close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I very happily and very gladly make this correction, and I thank Rabbi Lieberman for bringing it to my attention. Okay, now I want to pick up on page 255, volume 1, Chaslavich. Now, you see, Chazal already said, HaKol Tolui B'mazla Afilu Sefer Torah Shebeheichel. In life, certain things happen to us in life that at the time we don't realize how great, how lasting the influence is going to be. And it's just a chance happening. Everyone can look back in their own life, how you wind up in YU, how you wind up in Eretz Yisrael, how you wind up meeting your wife, how you wind up living in Eretz Yisrael. It's just sometimes what appears to you to be absolute chance. And that mazel, that chance, see, Chazal said it so beautiful. I see the Sefer Torah Shebeheichel. You go to the Heichal, there are 10 Sefer Torah. How many Sefer Torah do you have in the YU based Medrash in New York? You must have 18, 20, right or wrong. I remember in my youth there were so many. Which Torah do you take out? It's mazel. It's mazel for the Sefer Torah. Life is filled with mazel. The Rub's father went into the rabbinate. He leaves Prushana, leaves his father-in-law's home. He spent almost 10 years gegessen kest, supported by his father-in-law. The time has come to go out into the world. His first tell is Rezun, we spoke about it last week. Reb Moshe had a lot of less time, I should say. Reb Moshe had a lot of difficulty there. He did not find his way. It was a difficult beginning and a very difficult rabbinate. He was succeeding Rav Lapidot, who was a world-famous figure when he died, and Reb Moshe was only a youngster, and Reb Moshe was more brisk, and he was more of a posek, and more of an orator, and more of a political leader, and Reb Moshe did not have a happy experience in his first rabbinic position. And then he comes to Chaslavich. Now, let me say a few words about Chaslavich, which now I understand, and I didn't understand till I read Shulamit Meiselman's memoir. Do me a favor, wake up, Moshe. Moshe, listen carefully. Chaslavich was in the family blood. Rabbi Feinstein had been rabbi in Chaslavich. Reb Menachem Karakovsky, Reb Elia's son-in-law, Reb Moshe's brother-in-law, the Rub's uncle, you understand? Let me say it very simply. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik and Reb Nachum Krakowski married sisters, daughters of Reb Elia Feinstein, Reb Elia Prujana. The Rav revered his uncle. This was Reb Nachum Karakovsky. This is the author of the Avodat HaMelech on the Rambam. If you're not familiar with it, look at it in the library. And he leaves Chaslavich to become a Moritz Tzedek, a Dayan in Vilna, in Reb Chaim Moshe's Beis Din. You follow? So at this moment, the shtela becomes vacant. Reb Moshe now comes to a shtela where there's no opposition, where people are not going to eat his heart out. This is a shtela where his father-in-law was rabbi. This is a shtela where his brother-in-law is rabbi. This is a shtela where they're the happiest people alive to have the son of Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, as the Rav. And here you come to the famous story that the Rav told and retold, and I just want to call your attention to interesting details. Chaslavich was a Chabad town. The Rav used to speak about Chabad in White Russia, Lithuania. Chabad made tremendous inroads, and there were like 10 communities where you had tens of thousands of Hasidim, communities filled with Lubavitcher Hasidim. Lubavitch was by far the largest Hasidus in that area, perhaps at that time the largest Hasidus in the world, although in Poland you can't minimize Ger, and in Austro-Hungary you can't minimize Bells. But Lubavitch was powerful. How come they called in a Misnagdish Rav? And here's the story with Napoleon. You see, when Napoleon set out to conquer Europe, and this you have to understand, Napoleon was no Hitler. When I was a kid, they superficially taught us Napoleon was power crazy, power hungry Machiavelli. They compared him to Hitler, wanted to conquer the world. There's some truth in that. But Napoleon, first of all, believed he was civilizing the world. He believed that his code of law was the most advanced legal system in the world. Napoleon did not execute anybody, did not slaughter anybody. Napoleon sought to impose his authority to civilize the world, to bring it to a new level of civilization, to bring freedom and equality, social justice, etc. That he had a Napoleonic complex goes without saying. I've said that more than once. To be president of Yeshiva University, you understand, I've come up with a few names. But in order for these people to get off the floor, you have to have a bit of an ego. You have to have, remember, the meek shall inherit the earth, and that's all they deserve. Again, if you like Aaron Rakefit, so you wind up in a little classroom, Baruch Hashem, you're the happiest guy alive. Napoleon wasn't satisfied. He wanted to conquer the world, to civilize the world. There's a big difference. Now, there was a very basic machloket among the Jews. Is Napoleon good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? This machloket haunts us until today. The Bedichiva Rav felt very strongly. Napoleon was good for the Jews. He will bring them freedom. The Jews were suffering under the Tsar. They were politically oppressed. They were physically oppressed. There were pogroms. There were restrictions. They lived in abject poverty. Napoleon promised to integrate them. The Bedichiv Rav, Reb Levi, Yitzhak of Bedichiv saw what happened in France, how the Jews were integrated. The Jews were given freedom. The Jews were given power. The Jews had, remember, Napoleon convened the Sanhedrin. I can't go into details now, but I trust you know what I'm talking about. He convened Cain, Keilu, a Sanhedrin. I mean, this was fabulous. Here Jews are being kicked around, being spat at. And here in Paris, there's a Sanhedrin, Chol HaMoed Sukkos, paid for, sponsored by Napoleon the Emperor. Okay. On the other hand, look what happened in France. The minute you give the Jews freedom, the minute you welcome them, the minute you give them equal rights, assimilation sets in. Look at the United States. Look at the Western world. Look what we've gone through. Look at the silent Holocaust spiritually. Look at the intermarriage today. Look even in our so-called Orthodox circles, the problems we have on the left and on the right, living in a big culture beyond us which beckons to us and welcomes us. Look at Australia. Who's here from Australia? Australia is a country where the native Australians, there is absolutely no anti-Semitism whatsoever. 99.99% true. The native Australians receive a Jew as equal to any Christian, any non-Jew. There's absolutely no anti-Semitism. Look at the assimilation. Take a look what's happened. So now you have a machloket. What is better for the Jews? Political, cultural freedom, total religious freedom, no persecution, but it results, God forbid, in some assimilation? Or is it better to be persecuted, to be poor, to put down, not to have equal rights, but to remain Jews who are committed to Torah? And this is not a simple question. You understand, we can be big shots and raise the banner of YU and raise the banner of the modern world and show that we can integrate it. But habei chalalim hipila, until we reached where we are today, how many souls did we lose? How many millions did we lose? How many hundreds of thousands did we lose? So it's a very difficult question. And here there was a machloket, Tzivishin, the Lubavitcher, and the Bedichiva. The Bedichiva said, better France with all its spiritual problems. The Lubavitcher said, better Russia with all its physical problems. Now, and that's the famous story, and I footnote it, and I document it. that there was a Lubavitcher Chassid by the name of Moshe Merzlich. He knew French language. He spied for the Russians. The Rebbe sent them to spy. He brought back information. You got to remember, they were fighting front lines in Poland, in the cities, in White Russia. There's Napoleon, there's the French, there's the Russian troops. And Napoleon's army knew that the Lubavitcher Rebbe was behind this Merzlich, and they issued a death warrant, catch him and slaughter him. He's the cause of the spies. He's the cause of our troubles. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe had to run away, and he comes to the town of Chaslovich, and the Rav of Chaslovich is Rav Ashkenazi, the author of the Patash Shulchan, a Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon, a Litvak through and through, and they search for him in every house. And the French troops come to the house of the Rav, where the Baal Tanya is hiding in the basement, and the Pa'ata Shulchan says, "You're looking for the Lubavitcher Rebbe? If I had him, I would kill him. I would slaughter him. He's a chassid. You know that we Litvakin hate chassidim. I have not seen him." And the troops were so convinced that the Pa'ata Shulchan is telling the truth, they walked away, and this Talmud of the Vilna Gaon saved the life of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And as a result, in Chaslovich, Chok v'lo yavar, they always ruled that you had to have, despite the fact it was a Hasidish Lubavitcher town, the Rav had to be a Litvak, a Mitnagid, preferably from the Talmidei Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. And that's how Rabbi Elia Prishina gets there, that's Rabbi Nachum Karakovsky gets there, that's how Reb Moshe Soloveitchik gets there. Now, I call your attention to one little paragraph on page 256. And I stress again that every word I have here is from the Rav, taken from the tape, taken from the Hesped, from Reb Moshe Dov Berifkin that we spoke about last year. And the last paragraph is very revealing. You have to understand something. The Rav is a Litvak. The Rav is a Mitnagid. Time and again I've called your attention. The Rav suffered from Hasidisha Maisalach. Are they true? You know, Hasidisha stories, the miracles, what happens, the Rebbe, the salvation. Are they true? And here the Rav couldn't help it, he says. In my eyes, the story is authentic. In my youth, I heard about it from many of the older Hasidim in Chaslovich. I learned a great deal about Chabad when I resided there. And what's amazing here is the Rav authenticates the story, he says. Maybe a Hasidic story. Could be like many Hasidic stories, you don't have to take it verbatim. But he says, this story I had held from the elders here in Chaslovich. They're eyewitnesses to it. They have a living tradition. In my eyes, it's true. More than that. In 902, I repeat the same story as Menachem Kasdan swears he heard it from the Rav. And here there are additions that I know the Rav said over the years. He told the story hundreds of times, literally, not figuratively, hundreds of times. And each time he added what Menachem Kasdan has to say, coming back to the machloket between the Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Beditshuva. How come the Lubavitcher Rebbe went out? Because that Rosh Hashanah, while Napoleon is advancing, he got up earlier on Rosh Hashanah and blew shofar before the Beditshuva. And since he blew shofar earlier than the Beditshuva and was Mekayim Tiyat HaShofar earlier, the Hashkacha said the Lubavitcher Rebbe is right, and Napoleon was defeated, and the Jews remain Russian citizens. That's one little addition that you have to have a Hasidic feeling for, but it's not bad. He woke up earlier, flew shofar earlier. What's amazing is the last paragraph in 903. The Rav recalled that a child growing up in Chaslovich, and remember these were very formative years. This was Mazel. Had his father gone to some other community, the Rav would not have become the Rav. The Rav would not have been able to have a Talmud state on the greatest believer in pluralism after the Nasa V'Nishma. And the Rav recalled growing up in Chaslovich, he constantly observed that opposite the Mizrach Vant, the eastern wall of the synagogue, there was a spot where no one prayed. Tradition had it that this was the place where Reb Shneur Zalman prayed while running away from the French army. And let me tell you, I was just at 770 Eastern Parkway, and in the Beis Medrash, in the place where the Rebbe davened, can anyone tell me what's there? There is a chain blocking access. The place where the Rebbe davened, you cannot stand. You understand? So Yitzchak, you're sitting here and you're thinking, this is Hasidus. How foolish. What do you mean? The Lubavitcher Rebbe once prayed here 150 years ago. The seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe prayed here 15 years ago. So you block it? What are you accomplishing? Yitzchak, when was the last time you were back in Brookline? Did you see it with your own eyes? You walk into the Beis Medrash in Brookline and you expect the Rav and Rabbi Vogelmuth to walk in any second, exactly where they daven, the Shtenba, the name, Rav, J-B-S, right or wrong, no one goes near there. You don't need a chain, you don't need a fence. Every person is nisa not to walk where the Rav davened. And at the other end is Rabbi Yeshaya Vogelmuth, exactly the same thing. No one goes near. Is he still alive, by the way? He's still alive. But what condition is he in?
Old age home.
Old age home in New Jersey. Ach, nevach. Well, was that from a mensch, but exactly the same. So you see, cross-pollinization. You cannot mock the Hasidic world, because right in Boston, in the heart of Brookline, the heart of Litvish, the heart of Harvard, MIT, Radcliffe, the whole world, and there it is, where the Rav Davin, Chas V'Chalila, that J.J. Schachter or anyone else should dare to tread or dare to sit. Now, 903 is an unbelievable description. I take it out of a Yotzeit Drasha. It was a Meridik Drasha. And what the Rav says here, you see, this is mind-boggling. What has happened to us, what Kavodat Torah means, what Kavodat Torah was in Europe, where we're at today. Gentlemen, those of you that are going into the active rabbinate, you all know very well that Moshe Rabbeinu could not have been a Rav in the Western world today. No shtela would have selected Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest Jew that ever lived. Can anyone tell me why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu could not speak well. He was a kfat peh. He stuttered. And can you picture a rabbi who cannot speak well, who stutters, holding down Kehillat Jeshurun, KJ, Rabbi Haskell Lukstein, holding down Oheb Tzedek, Rabbi Alan Schwartz, holding down Jewish Center, Ari Berman, holding down Lincoln Square, Adam Mintz, you name the shul, Alphalin, the rabbi. Can you picture Moshe Rabbeinu stuttering and trying to be elected to one of these shuls? I got up in Lido Beach 2 weeks ago on Shabbat, and I said, Moshe, Morai v'Rabotai, when a rabbi gets up to speak, he's giving the drasha, I said to the Kehila in Lido Beach, and remember Lido Beach during the year is a low-level community with a handful of balabatim. During the summer, it becomes like a whale. During the year, it's a dinosaur. During the summer, it's a big, tremendous whale. All the balabatim from Manhattan, the west side and the east side, have summer homes in Lido Beach, and there they are in this shul. I said, Moravi Rabbatai, when a rabbi gets up to speak, he has 2 minutes in which to capture the congregation. If he doesn't get them interested in the first 2 minutes, they go to sleep. And balabatim have a very unique ability that it's not just to go to sleep when the rabbi starts speaking. The minute the rabbi ends, they wake up. It's like an alarm clock. I don't mind them going to sleep. But Ribbono Shel Olam, how do they know how to wake up 18, 19 minutes later? Now, at this point, they're all falling off their seats. I said, in the army, I had only 1 minute to capture the audience. Whenever I began a lecture in the army, I began by saying, when a Jew walks into his house, he has a holy obligation to kiss the mezuzah, the TV screen, and his wife. And in that order, mezuzah, TV screen, wife. And I gave my whole drasha. And I want to tell you, I don't want to mention the names to the balabatim, but they were awake all 18 minutes and 47 seconds. They were falling off their seat. That's what goes on in the United States today. If you can't give a sermon, if you can't catch them, if you can't tell them to kiss the screen of the TV, they don't even want to listen to you. They turn themselves off. They went to sleep and they had insult injury. The minute you finish, they're awake. Modani, it's fabulous. They're davening, you can pook and whatever it is. The Chatzi Kaddish, the Shmon Esrei. It's as if the rabbi didn't exist. Okay. This description of Haslovich is a description of Kavod HaTorah. The Rav was describing in the Yotzeit Drasha how, and this was his youth, this is his youth, he describes the shul in Haslovich could sit 1,000 people, and remember, it's the impressions of our youth that stay with us all our life. Once you hit 21, 22, you're no longer young, you're no longer impressionable, you're already, your mind is made up. I've told you, I taught many years, 20 years I taught in BMT, from the original faculty, 69 to 89. You know how many kids I influenced? How many kids became B'nai Torah? How many kids came in Aliyah? How many kids sacrificed their lives for Torah and Yirat Shemayim, the State of Israel, some lo aleinu figuratively, and some unfortunately literally? All the result of BMT. You can teach Nikola from today to tomorrow. You influence nobody. Because the kid Nikola is 24, 25, 26. His mind is made up. He's established. Nothing budgets him. Nothing moves him. But a kid. And the Rav describes the Beis Medrash in Haslovich. 1,000 people could crowd in. And he describes his father speaking on Shabbos HaGadol, his father speaking on Shabbos Triva, his father giving a drasha. And the Rav says, my father gave a brisk drasha with difficult Rambams. He says, perhaps out of 1,000 people, 100 understood him. Perhaps I'll be kind, I'll say 150 understood him. But 1,000 people, he says, if you could see the way the eyes of the shoemakers and the carpenters and the panhandlers and all the different type of tipusim and the peddlers and the beggars and all the different type of tipusim you had, their eyes were on my father for an hour and a half, for the entire drasha, as if they comprehended, understood every word, filled with kavod HaTorah, filled with love, filled with Yirat HaKavod, with Yirat HaRomamot. You might have imagined that my father was telling them a simple story instead of a profound drasha. They seemed to have endless joy from his presentation and the atmosphere of the shul during the drasha. Yet I can guarantee you that most of these Jews did not understand one word of my father's drasha. But this was Europe. This was Haslovich. This is the way they related to a Rav. This was the Yirat HaKavod. This was the Hasidic masses relating to the Litvisher Rav, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. The crowded sukkah, this too, I heard. The Rav spoke about this once when he was teaching Masechet Sukkah in Moria, but I cite Tova Lichtenstein here. I heard the story from her. It's a Meredith story. Gentlemen, you don't know how fortunate we are. We get married today in the State of Israel. You buy an apartment. One of the things we look for is a sukkah mirpeset, a sukkah terrace. All right, here you have a communal sukkah. You're not yet on your balabatim of your own. In the United States, many people have their own homes. They build a sukkah. It's a fabulous world today. When I grew up, who saw a sukkah? Who could build a sukkah? Who had place to build a sukkah? We had tremendous apartment buildings in the Bronx. The only place that a sukkah was ever built was in the shul. And you had to arrange to eat in the shul. It was not easy. And Shabbos, with the carrying problems, indescribable, the gymnastics we went through, l'kayem mitzvah sukkah, when I was a kid. Today, I'm ashamed to tell you, what's when sukkah? It's the easiest thing in the world. I walk out from my terrace into my sukkah. What kind of schar? No schar halicha, no schar anything. It's mamish, as easy as can be. One of my son-in-laws has a lifts off his roof in the house, puts on schach, now he builds a sukkah downstairs, he sleeps in the sukkah, the kids sleep in the sukkah, so he has a sukkah upstairs, a sukkah downstairs, called Hamaber, HaRezim Meshuvach, Baruch Hashem. But the Rav here describes sukkahs in Haslovich, and this shows you the elichkeit, that no one could build their own sukkah. The community used to build one sukkah together. And in that sukkah, they brought in their tables, and they ate in the sukkah, and there was one Jew, Yusha Eaton, as I recall, that's the name Tova told me. One Jew would come in, bring in his table, and next to the table he would bring in a bed to sleep in the sukkah. The Balabatim would go crazy. The Allah Balabatim would say, what are you out of your mind? There's barely enough room for everyone to eat in the sukkah. We're talking 1,000 Jews have to eat in one sukkah. 1,000 Jews. Multiply that by their families. And you're bringing in a bed? And they would bring him to Din Torah before Rav Moshe. And Rav Moshe would say to him, what are you bringing in the sukkah? This would go on every year. Say to Rabbi Yeshua, what are you bringing in the sukkah? You know no one's going to sleep in the sukkah. You know it's too cold that night. You know that we have a din. By the way, this is part of the fact that the Hasidim, the Lubavitchers, don't sleep in a sukkah. The Belzer don't sleep in a sukkah. Never. Some of us in this room don't sleep in a sukkah. Well, let me just talk about myself and not indict anyone else. How were we brought up not to sleep in a sukkah? And it goes back to the fact that in Europe, those of you that have been to Russia, October, there's already snow on the ground. You're going to sleep in a sukkah? Halavai, you should be able to eat in a sukkah. There shouldn't be snow. There shouldn't be rain. It's too cold. It's mitzvah. It's impossible. So Rav Moshe says to him, Rav Yasha, what are you bringing your bed in? You know you can't sleep. You know that it's too cold. And he answers him, Rebbe, you're absolutely right. I know I'm not going to sleep. But if I don't bring my bed in, I show HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I have no kavanah to sleep. I don't want to sleep. I bring my bed in because I know I'll have to take it out. But I want the Yebishter to see that I'm willing to sleep in the sukkah. But the Rav is paskin, there's no chiyav or amputa from sleeping because it's mitztayeh, it's too cold. And you see, that's the type of Jew you had in Haslavich. Understand? This is a magnificent description that he brings in his bed on and not to take it out because he doesn't want the Eibishter to think that chas v'chalila, he knows lachatchila, he's not going to sleep in the sukkah. He wants to sleep in the sukkah. He dreams about sleeping in the sukkah. But what can he do? Mitztayeh, put them in a sukkah. And now that the Rav Paskin, Wadi Paskin, he carries out the bed, the machloket comes to an end. I can tell you as follows. My wife's family is in America many years. Might even be from the 1870s. We don't know for sure. My wife has a great-great-grandparents buried in Queens, Ad Kedei Kach. A great-great-grandparent. So my wife's grandfather, these were Pelish Yidden, never took his beard off all the years he lived in America. East New York, he lived in a big apartment house, but they lived on the first floor. He would build a sukkah on the street outside his window. Some people complained. Police came along, it's an absolute true story, gave him a ticket, he had to appear before a judge, got a summons. He's building a sukkah on public property, would appear before a judge, and year after year, it was a Jewish judge, a non-Jewish judge, but in New York already they knew what was going on. The judge would rule, okay, you've over, I sentenced you, that within 10 days you will have the sukkah down. Gave him an extra day, you know, after Shmini Atzeres and Chas Torah, gave him an extra day to take the sukkah down. But that is somewhat like the story you have here, where look at devotion, look at the dedication. Let me go one step further. 905, a student spy network. I heard this from Tova as well. Tova said, her father, time and time would tell the story. And you'll see my footnote here. It's an interesting footnote. I'll tell you why in a second. The students in Haslovich went to Cheder. In Cheder, they ran a spy network. What was the spy network? They wanted to know when a woman gave birth. The minute the woman gave birth, they would find out whether it's a boy or a girl, and they would visit the hospital every night or where the woman gave birth. It wasn't in the hospital, I should say. It was at home. They would stand outside the window and recite Kriyat Shema. Why did they do this? Because as a reward for their efforts, they got candy and cake. Now, what's going on here? Have you ever researched this custom? Why don't we do it today? Before a baby has a brit milah, according to the Kabbalah, the bad elements, the evil elements are trying to harm the baby, that chas v'chalila, he shouldn't be mekayim, the great mitzvah of milah. And that's why the night before the Brit, all the children gather and they say Kriyat Shema. Well, if the bad elements, if the Sitra Acher is ready to attack the baby even before the Brit, Why only the night before? Look into my footnote. Bizman hazeh, where the women give birth in hospitals, this custom was mitigated, was minimized. You're not going to have kids coming to a hospital. Kids aren't even allowed into a hospital for many different reasons. They can get illness, they can bring an illness, etc. So we wait until the night before, and that's the night of Kriyat Shema, the last night when generally the infant is home. That's when they do it. At the time of Chaslovich, they did it every night. So that's why that custom was to do it every night. What's beautiful here is how kids remain kids. Nothing has changed. Watch in a shul at a bar mitzvah. Watch in a shul at an ufrav. Watch in a shul where they're going to throw candy. I have been in the wealthiest neighborhoods. Ribbono shel Olam, I mentioned Lido Beach. Let's talk about Muncie. Let's talk about Teaneck. Let's talk about Lawrence. I mean, with all the recession today and the stock market and what's going on with the interest rates, and I'm well aware of it, because anyone who is involved in fundraising knows that to raise funds today, Lichman Tiftayer and Dred, our Jews are suffering on paper. I say on paper because Baruch Hashem, they're still leading. But look at these kids. You can have a kid, he comes from a home where he has one room for his bed, one room for his TV, one room for his playthings. He has another four sisters and brothers. Each one has three different rooms at their disposal. Ribbono shel Olam, they lack absolutely nothing. They'll go to Israel, do their parents a whole favor. They'll come home, they'll have a payoff, their own car waiting for them in the driveway. Here's the key sandal. You spent a year in BMT, you spent a year in KBY, you spent a year in Hakotel. Now this is your reward. These kids lack for nothing. Take a look at these little kids, how they're plotting where they're going to position themselves in the synagogue to catch the candy, to jump for the candy. And then if chas v'chalila, you find, an adult finds a candy, now what can you do? It's before Kiddush. You can't suck candy before Kiddush. Can I hurry? We're all well. We're all healthy. We don't have heart problems. So what do you do with the candy? You give it to a kid. You give a kid, this kid comes from a family that's worth X millions of dollars. Right? And you give this little kid one little hard candy that you caught, his face lights up like you gave him Malchut Shemaim, you understand? And nothing has changed. Kids remain kids, candy remains candy, cake remains cake, and it shows you that in Chaslovich, how industrious the youngsters were, that they had their own spy system. And this is the same spy system. Here it's being used for a good purpose, to find out when a woman gave birth to a boy, there has to be a grit, there has to be a shmira, you have to fight the elements that are coming in to harm the baby. This is the same spy system that we spoke about last year when the Rebbe in Cheder taught Tanya, and the boys put the Tanya on top of the Gemara. And there's the Rebbe teaching in Cheder, Tanya b'sheli perik, the gimel d'ni, the mashbin otev te tzadik, v'yalta hei rasha. And the Baal Tanya continues, and there's Rebbe Moshe Soloveitcher coming to check if the Rebbe is making progress in teaching Gemara. And the spies are standing outside the Cheder, and they give the signal, Rebbe Moshe is coming. Immediately, the Tanyas disappear, and the Gemara is open, and the kids are all chiming and chanting, you understand? This is the same spy system. So it shows you, just as the fellas in my time in YU were smarter than their rebbeim, and we knew how to negotiate and to maneuver to between Rav Yerucham Gerelik, between Shmuel Elazar Volk, or with the Rav, we didn't maneuver, we were frightened stiff in my time. That's a different story. But even with the Rav, we tried our best to keep our heads above water. Baruch Hashem, you guys had a gnomon who had a maneuver between your rebbeim. I don't know what goes on today, but all right, you have rebbeim, Gedoli Yisrael, with various opinions, Rabbi Heschel Schechter, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, and everyone else in the greater YU setup. So Baruch Hashem, don't think you discovered America. Right back in Chaslovich, those kids knew how to maneuver beautifully and knew how to keep their sense of balance, and above all, knew how to get the candy and the cake. And these are the experiences. This is what colored the Rav. This is what influenced the Rav. Chaslovich are his most formative years. You will never find him talking about Warsaw or talking about Berlin the way he talks about Haslovich. This is his youth. These are his most impressionable years. These are his teen years. These are the years that forged him, that formed him. So to reiterate, so far today, what did we do? We introduced the course. I made one addendum, and it's not a correction, because whoever told Rav David Cohen that I said that he called Rav Hutner incorrect. I said there was a shmua. I was sitting inside. They said he went out and into the phone booth. He says too there was a shmua. But what's amazing is what comes out of the incorrect information told to him. You now hear the Baldovich himself, and you see that little Lonnie Rothkopf sitting there as a kid, and Rav David Cohen are relating exactly the same story. But he adds on two pratim that I didn't know. One prat was, I remember they charged, and he says, Durvi Hartman, if not that I love you, I would kill you. And now think 40 years later, who Reb David Cohen is telling this to, a semi-YU audience, and think where David Hartman is today. Unbelievable. Al tamin v'yatzmacha ad yom motcha. Period. Every word that Chazal said is true. Not to be literally, figuratively, every syllable true. The other point that Rav Hutner calls him the next day, Al Yovoshu Bifnei Hamaligim. That is unbelievable. And for future historians, it's just another incident that could be illustrated where the unfortunate schism comes in, the unfortunate cleavage that we have today between the right and the left. That a person like myself, those of you that know me, know that I'm not, I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm not happy with that spit. I'm not happy with the schism, but I have to live with it. Yeah, certain things I agree, this, whatever it is, it's unimportant. That doesn't mean that I follow everything my Rebbe taught me. He wouldn't let us be Hasidim, so I'm not a Hasid, I'm a Talmud, there's a difference. Okay. Then we went into a correction. We came into Chabad, we went into a correction. And then I did some of the material, and I'm very thankful for that correction. No, it's a minor correction, but nevertheless, scholarship means you have to be ultimately totally honest. And I'm so happy because I made a mistake. I didn't know, you know, Rabbi Jacobson. I figured that's the Rabbi Jacobson, must be the father. Because the publisher of the Mogul Altamente Journal always talks about his father. So I figured that had to be his father. But that was a magic moment in my life that I had the schut to be sitting there, kol tului b'mazel, when Rabbis Jacobson and Gordon walked in, and my conversation with the Rav afterwards that colors my thinking until this very minute, Baruch Hashem. Then we went into some examples about Haslovich, why a non-Chabad Rav in a Chabad community, the Lubavitcher, the Bedichiva, the true story, the place where no one stands, the type of Jews that lived in Haslovich. But I have to tell you what I begin next week with is second to none, because next week we come into the heart of a philosophic question that haunts the Rav, that haunts him in all his writings, and you see the way he handles it so beautifully within the context of the Kinnot. Now, the freebies. We begin with the minor to the major, although the minor is very major. This is my Xerox copy of the original printing of the Ish Halacha. This is the copy I took with me to the army. This is the copy I worked on. If anyone is interested, you're welcome to it. It's from the original. Pass it back to Dr. Jackson. Now, for years, I had a bootleg copy. Rabbi Rubin gave this to me many years ago, one of my most precious gifts. This was a volume that the Liechtenstein stopped distribution. The volume just came out 3 weeks ago, and I now own 5 copies of it. If anyone wants the bootlegged photograph, it's exactly the same as what has been published. You want it? Give it back to Rabbi Rubin. It's his copy to be given. But I have a second copy, because a certain Rosh Yeshiva in YU, pass it back to the end, the guy next to Moshe, a Rosh Yeshiva in YU asked me to copy it for him. He's going to come this October and get it from me, and now it's absolutely worthless. A Rosh Yeshiva in YU, let him remain nameless, because he wanted to take counterband for me, you understand? Forbidden material, robbed thieves. The only heter we have, Chaim, is a shach and chosh and mishpat. Baruch Hashem, on that shach, I live. No, it came out, the title page is one addendum to it. This was published without the permission of the family. Without the permission. That's what it says. The family bears no responsibility.